Good afternoon. My name is Maine, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to today's ADA call, Sign Language Interpreting and Video Remote Interpreting in Medical Setting. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, please press the pound key. Thank you. Ms. Robbins-Jones, you may begin your conference.
Thank you, and welcome everyone to today's session. And thank you very much for joining us. Before we turn it over to our presenter, I just want to make a few remarks and orient some people to the process of today's call if you're not familiar with the ADA Audio Conference Series. The ADA Audio Conference Series is brought to you as a collaboration between the Great Lakes ADA Center and the ADA National Network. A couple of the technologies related to today, we have people who are connected by telephone, and we have people who are connected to us by the webinar platform. In the webinar platform, we're offering the option for real-time captioning as well as video remote interpreting. So I'm going to go through some of the instructions today that hopefully will help people understand a little bit more about the platform before we start. Again, if you're listening through your webinar through the sound, make sure that your speakers are turned on or your headphones are plugged in. If you're having any problems with your sound broadcast, you can check that out by, one, try the sliding bar left or right to make sure that you're getting full access to your sound. If you're still having problems, quality problems, you can use the little microphone icon, which is in the upper top right-hand corner of the audio and video panel. It's blue with a little red star on it. That's an audio wizard and should help you clear up some of your sound problems if you're having any. If you're on your mobile device, you can use your the Blackboard Collaborate mobile app, which was available in advance for download. Please note, though, that there is some limited accessibility in the mobile app. Captioning is available. You can use the CC icon in the audio and video panel. It will open a dialog box. Once you've selected it, you can resize the captioning window, change the font size, as well as save the transcript. We're also using Sign Language Interpreter today. Video Sign Language is available for this session by choosing the video panel in the audio and video, open a video window. To ensure that your system remains focused on the Sign Language Interpreter, make sure everything is unchecked in the Options menu, which is in the upper right-hand corner of the video panel. The little diagram there shows you. A little drop-down, make sure everything is unchecked. We will be taking questions, as you heard the operator say today. For those on the telephone, we will be giving you verbal instructions on how to do that. If you are in the webinar platform, you can submit your questions in the chat area. They are only visible to the presenters. They are not visible to anyone else. If you're on the mobile app, you can submit your questions in the chat area within the app. You also have the option of emailing your questions to webinars@adaaudio.org. Please note that this session is being recorded and it will be available within several days of the website, of the session on the website for your review again. You can also customize your view of the slides today. The default is as you see it currently. If you would like to see a larger view of the slides or a smaller view, you can adjust that by using the drop-down menu in the upper left-hand corner of the whiteboard area where the slides are now presented. You also can resize any of the boxes, the video panel, the chat area, etc., by either stretching it with your mouse and or detaching it. To detach it, you will use the little icon in the upper right-hand corner of each of the boxes and choose detach. That will allow you to move it around, stretch it, make it larger or smaller. If you're experiencing any technical difficulties today, you can send a private chat to Great Lakes ADA in the menu bar under the attendees. You can send an email to webinars@ada-audio.org or call our office at 877-232-1990. Both voice and TTY, and someone will assist you. So at this time, without further ado, we would like to turn this over to our presenter today, Shannon Montino. Shannon works for the Great Lakes ADA Center as a program specialist and is involved in our outreach to the deaf and hard of hearing community and ensuring that there is access to information related to the responsibilities and obligations of individuals and entities under the Americans with Disabilities Act for effective communication and the provision of auxiliary aids and services. You can read more about Shannon on her bio on the website at www.audio-ada-audio.org. So at this time, I'm going to go ahead and turn over the microphone to Shannon. Shannon, it's all yours.
Thank you, Robin. Thank you for that introduction, and thank you, everyone, for joining us today. In addition to the brief bio that Robin just shared about my experience, I've spent 10 years as a nationally certified sign language interpreter, working freelance, working a lot in medical settings, and so some of this information is coming directly from personal experience. The agenda today will give you a brief orientation on deafness, mostly just to give you a better idea of who your patients are, who your clients are, and how best to serve them. We'll go over some legal requirements required to achieve effective communication. We will define effective communication and auxiliary aids. Discuss interpreter qualifications, because those do differ state by state, and the ADA and other laws regarding interpreter qualifications are intentionally vague about this, so we'll try to clear up some of that, those issues. We'll define and discuss the use of sign language interpreters, deaf interpreters, video remote interpreting, and video relay service. That can easily sometimes get confused on what accommodation is required and which one you need. VRI versus live interpreter. Live interpreter refers to an on-site interpreter versus an interpreter on a screen. Sometimes people will say an on-site interpreter or an in-person interpreter. This is what they mean when they say those words. We'll go over some case law regarding VRI and the use of sign language interpreting as an accommodation, and then give some of my personal insider knowledge, what I wish every provider knew in terms of going beyond reasonable accommodations, going beyond the ADA's minimal standards. This is a minimum standard, but there's more that you could do if you're really going for equitable service to these patients. All right, so deafness, deaf people obviously are not a one-size-fits-all cookie-cutter experience. There are some people with mild to moderate hearing loss, and these people might use hearing aids and based on judging what it looks like, they're keeping up with conversations, no problem. People with mild or moderate hearing loss might identify as deaf. They might identify as part of the deaf community, but they, judging by their communication methods, they may present very different communication abilities than your next patient who shows up and has severe or profound hearing loss. Severe hearing loss, these are people who also often use sign language. They possibly have very powerful hearing aids that allow them to still rely heavily on lip reading but be able to carry on a conversation if the context of the situation allows for that. If the situation is loud, if there are multiple people speaking over each other, if the conversation is bouncing between multiple members quickly, then a person using hearing aids and depending on lip reading will maybe not be able to keep up with a conversation so well. People with profound hearing loss, these are typically people who are born deaf or become deaf very early on in life. They will use sign language or other forms of non-vocalized communication, such as cued speech or other systems, and we'll get into that a little bit more later. But I just want you to keep in mind that you might have experience with a person who identifies as deaf but does not request accommodations, is able to lip read and carry on an appointment or, an emergency room experience just fine, and then the very next person comes in, identifies as deaf, requests a sign language interpreter, does not lip read, et cetera. So keep that in mind. Every deaf person is different, and they are going to be the expert on how they best communicate. Also thrown in here, late deafened individuals. This is people who we usually see become sometimes severely deaf with age, but because they've lived most of their life as a hearing person speaking and listening, they typically do not learn sign language, they do not use sign language. And so with these people, it's best to, again, ask them what they prefer, but they might use CART, which is a live captioning service, or writing back and forth, that kind of thing. And then just a note for going forward, in PC American culture, there's been an effort to say hearing impaired. There's some ideas that this is, I guess, less offensive than other labels, but deaf and hard of hearing people actually do not prefer that label. They prefer to be called deaf and hard of hearing. To call someone deaf when they are deaf, they know they're deaf. If you say that they're deaf, you're not being offensive at all. So deaf and hard of hearing is what I suggest that you use going forward. The lip reading myth. So lip reading as an effective mode of communication is a myth that is perpetuated by, I guess, social media and movies and TV. It seems that every time Marley Matlin is cast in a TV series or a movie, she's able to magically, perfectly lip read everyone around her, even when their backs are to her. And this really is not the case. About 60% of all the speech sounds made in English are not presented on the lips. So these are sounds that are going to be made, you know, behind your teeth, the back of your tongue, in your throat, which makes lip reading nearly impossible. The average rate of accuracy for lip reading is about 12.4% you see here, and then the best lip readers in the nation are still only getting about 30% accuracy from lip reading. So if you think about the context of a medical situation where somebody's health or ideas of consent are being based on the idea that they're getting only 30% of the information, makes for some very precarious situations in terms of effective communication. So I would suggest that you not initiate, an appointment by asking the deaf person to lip read. You're going to get yourself into some deep water real quick. Lip reading also depends on the deaf person's contextual knowledge of the subject. If you switch subjects on them real quick, did you let them know, now we're talking about X, Y, and Z instead of something else, and do they know about the subject well enough to keep up with lip reading? It's definitely beneficial if they are lip reading to have a one-on-one setting. When communication bounces around from a circle of people quickly, trying to figure out who's talking and turn your attention to them without hearing where the conversation is going to be problematic. Definitely you need eye contact. If you have a doctor or a nurse or something who is talking to a person who's trying to lip read them, and then immediately they bury their face in their chart or turn around to the machine behind them, obviously that cuts off any kind of successful lip reading. Things like having a clean shaven face, is your facial hair covering your lips, standard mouth shape and speech production, do you have an accent? And it also just requires, I mean, it's slow. There will be a lot of miscommunication and asking for clarification. So it requires a lot of patience, and also keeping in mind that it probably will fail, and when that does, you need written communication as a backup. Deaf people who identify as culturally deaf usually also identify as a visually oriented people. So if you are not hearing the world around you, you are depending on your eyes for all incoming information. So culturally deaf means typically people who use sign language, and there is a set of social beliefs, behaviors, art, literary traditions, history, values, and shared institutions of communities that are influenced by deafness and this idea of a visual world. in the bottom right-hand corner, you can see an image I have labeled ICE. It's an image of a globe or the world as an eyeball. So there's a cultural joke, I guess, that Earth is spelled E-A-R-T-H, Earth, and that deaf people live on ice. So just if you keep that in mind as you go forward with your deaf patients, think of how can you make this experience, this medical experience, as visual as possible. So if you know that somebody is coming in to discuss a knee replacement, do you have posters or pictures of knee replacement equipment and the procedure? Can you pull up a video on YouTube right there in your office that is going to more visually explain to this person what's actually going to happen? That's an example of an equitable service, just thinking best, how best to serve your patients. And then sometimes some deaf people have a tradition of more straightforward communication. This is often a cultural trait, and it comes from a legacy or, I guess, decades of being misunderstood, of having miscommunication, and, you know, there's a cultural trait of not wanting to beat around the bush. Just get me the information that I need to know. And keep this in mind as you work with deaf patients. But then also, sometimes if there are bristled comments that are coming from the deaf patient, maybe there's a frustration of some kind, keep this in mind that this is a cultural difference, and these are two cultures coming face-to-face, hearing culture and deaf culture, and that may be part of what's going on with this style of communication. Slide 15. These are other issues to consider as you serve this population. Again, this is not every deaf person out there, but some deaf people, their literacy levels are low or non-existent in terms of reading and writing English. So as an interpreter from experience, I know that when a nurse has said, you know, do you read English or Spanish? And because they're preparing to give them some kind of paperwork, the deaf person's response is something lighter with, I'm not so great with English, ASL is my primary language. And I want to caution you, when you get this kind of a response, it may be that it's not that they're not so great with English, but that they may not be literate at all. And so when you have patients, whether they're deaf or hearing, who are illiterate, how do you best serve these patients? What kind of resources are you able to give or reach out to supplement information that they might need? Limited peripheral learning. A professor of mine who is a deaf professional, has a master's degree, is highly successful, lives in Washington, D.C., she had told me a story that simple things like dentists that tell you should replace your toothbrush every 3 months. And this is something that I remember learning as a child, and I heard it kind of in my periphery repeatedly. And it's just something that I always knew. You replace a toothbrush every 3 months. Nobody had taken the time to actually communicate that to her until she was about 37 years old. She went to the dentist. This was, you know, her how many hundredth time at the dentist, and it was only then that the dentist took the time to write out to her, replace your toothbrush every 3 months, floss morning and evening. So keep that in mind when you're serving this population. Health information that may seem common sense to you and I may not be accessible to this population, and just to make sure that there is effective communication holistically around that. Family networks. I can't remember the exact statistic, but it's something like 60% of hearing parents who have deaf children never learn to sign. And that may sound extreme or unbelievable, but it is the truth. It's confirmed definitely by my own experience. And for that reason, I have that in here. I know that as medical professionals, many people are used to family networks being comprised of all sorts. When you have hearing family members coming in with deaf family members speaking for a deaf family member, I would caution to know what is this relationship, how fluent is that parent or family member in sign language, are they kind of taking over that communication. I had a situation one time where a sister was legal guardian of their family member, did not know sign language at all, and the patient had severe pain for a month, and the sister did not even know the sign for pain, and was really unable to communicate that to doctors. So family members, to use family members as interpreters for their deaf family members is, it's a struggle sometimes, and a word of caution there. And then other issues to consider too. This population is not just deaf. A lot of times we'll have deaf people who are also blind, deaf people who have low vision. There's deaf immigrants whose first language is not English. It's not American Sign Language. It's something completely different. So how do we serve that population? How do we work toward effective communication? And then this word deaf plus, it's not quite a standard vocabulary within the field yet, but I've heard it a few times. Basically, it just means deaf plus other disabilities. Does this deaf person have CP? Does this deaf person have, you know, you name it? And to make sure that we're accommodating for that as well. Slide 16. So these are some of the laws that, these are the laws that cover medical facilities and the require effective communication. So the Americans with Disabilities Act, Title II and III, Affordable Care Act, specifically Section 1557, and the Rehabilitation Act, Section 504. And a lot of the language in these laws specifically about effective communication and providing auxiliary aids, providing accommodations toward effective communication is very similar. The ADA defines disability as a person with a disability is a person who has a physical or mental impairment that substantially limits one or more major life activity. This includes people who have a record of such impairment. Even if they do not currently have a disability, it also includes individuals who do not have a disability but are regarded as having a disability. The ADA also makes it unlawful to discriminate against a person based on that person's association with a person with disability. So deafness is and being hard of hearing is usually, there's no argument there, it's usually a given. This falls within that definition of disability under the ADA. I want to bring your attention also to the last line of that definition, that the ADA makes it unlawful to discriminate against a person based on that person's association with a person with a disability. So sometimes we see this in terms of companions. If there's a deaf patient and their family member, their friend who is their as a part of their care team, as a visitor, et cetera, also needs accommodations. Accommodations extend to those companions. Going forward, so what is effective communication, and when is communication effective? This is slide 17. So you know communication is effective when the patient understands the information. This may seem like common sense, but how do you know that you have achieved effective communication? How do you know that the patient understands the information? The only way to really truly know for yourself if the patient has understood the information given is to ask the patient to repeat back to you what they have understood, what you have just said. This may seem slow and tedious, but it is the most effective way for you to confirm for yourself that communication has happened, that the patient understands. If you have a patient who is unable to understand, maybe because they need a deaf interpreter, we'll get into that in a minute, then, you know, further research needs to be done into how to effectively communicate with this patient. They may need more than just the sign language interpreter or just the VRI or CART or lip reading or whatever it is that you have tried for thus far. Sometimes people have asked, you know, I've hired the sign language interpreter. We've even hired the deaf interpreter, and they still don't understand. Well, sometimes you have patients who are not going to understand. And when you have a hearing patient who doesn't understand you after you've made various attempts to make that communication understood, what do you do in those situations? How do you mark that down? And that is obviously within your professional practice. But in terms of, you know, most people, effective communication is when the patient understands, and the best way to ensure that for yourself is to ask. Qualified interpreter. The laws that we just named, the ADA, the Rehab Act, and the Affordable Care Act, have very similar language around qualified interpreter, and it's intentionally vague. It says a qualified interpreter is one who is able to interpret effectively, accurately, and impartially, both receptively and expressively, using any necessary specialized vocabulary. An individual does not have to be certified in order to meet this standard. A certified interpreter may not meet this standard in all situations where the interpreter is not familiar with the specialized vocabulary involved in the communication. So be aware that state laws may require certified interpreters superseding the ADA, and be sure to check those local laws. So certified does not necessarily mean qualified, and vice versa. However, state laws, certain states have very strict state licensure laws that require interpreters who work in highly nuanced situations or situations with more liability, such as medical, or legal, require very specific state licensure. So make sure that you check that before you hire an interpreter. I know here in Illinois we have these laws. But in states like New York, there is no state law yet. So in terms of medical, it's still best practices to find an interpreter who has some kind of credentials and experience in what you need them for. Each state is different, so just check that. Family members are not considered appropriate interpreters because of their emotional or personal involvement in the situation, and because it would be difficult to maintain that impartiality, especially if a situation maybe starts out as very simple, you think innocuous, and then a surprise diagnosis is found, and suddenly your interpreter is, you know, emotional and trying to straddle the duties of being an interpreter and a supportive family member at the same time. It's best just to rely on the professionals. There's a fact sheet that the ADA Network has put out on effective communication, and that link is here for your reference after the webinar. Going on to slide 18, the Americans with Disabilities Act, Titles 2 and 3. Title 2 covers state and local government services, so this is state hospitals, county hospitals, public doctor's offices like this that is receiving state or local funds. Title 3 is private businesses, nonprofit organizations that serve the public. So this is most hospitals, most doctor's offices, small practices. It could be a dentist's office, a nursing home, a psychological facility, even care that extends into the private home of someone. But obviously that private care is being coordinated by a private business, private organization. And so Titles 2 and 3 are what we look to in the ADA in terms of providing accommodations for effective communication. All right, slide 19 is the Affordable Care Act. It has a lot of the same information, a lot of the same language as the ADA, but section 1557 specifically has this, if the third bullet point down, primary consideration, which means that the public entity is encouraged to honor the choice of accommodation that the individual with a disability specifies, with certain exceptions. So this is saying that the ACA is encouraging you to make contact with your deaf patient, ask them what they prefer. Do they prefer a sign language interpreter on site? Do they prefer VRI? Do they prefer captioning? Do they prefer something else? And then do your best to meet that request. Sometimes, especially in rural areas, a live on-site interpreter may not be readily available, and so you have to use VRI or you have to use some other mode of communication accommodation. But to be able to show your patient that, hey, look, we tried to find an on-site interpreter and could not make that happen, that is what this primary consideration means. And again, the individual with a disability, the deaf person is going to be the expert on what is most effective for communication with them. So to make contact with them before the situation arises and know how to best interact with them. Slide 20, this is the Rehabilitation Act, Section 504. I'm going to mostly skip over it because it does have a lot of the same language as the ADA and the ACA. But keep in mind, the Rehabilitation Act covers federal entities. So if a medical facility is receiving federal funds, so this includes Medicaid, then you are not only covered by the ADA, but also by the Rehabilitation Act to provide accommodations for communication. Slide 21. The ADA and providing accommodations does have some limitations. There are specifically two under the ADA. There's fundamental alteration. So if the provision of an accommodation fundamentally alters the nature of services being provided, then the entity is not required to provide that that accommodation. And then undue burden. Fundamental alteration, we really don't see that in the context of providing communication accommodations. Undue burden, there have been some attempts to claim that that providing sign language interpreting is too expensive, it's an undue burden on the business. We have not seen any case law uphold these claims, so undue burden is when providing whatever accommodation under the ADA is, it exceeds the overall funds of the business. In simplified terms, this means by providing this accommodation, your practice, your hospital, your facility will have to declare bankruptcy. And you might see this more often with the idea of installing an elevator, which could easily be a $20,000 building alteration that could warrant a claim of undue burden. But with sign language interpreting, it usually is going to cost a couple hundred dollars. There are some extreme cases, but a couple hundred dollars, which is not going to stand up in court as undue burden. There was a lawsuit brought, this Garina and Forgari in 2008, New Jersey. A physician refused to provide an ASL interpreter because the hourly rate of the interpreter was higher than the hourly rate of the physician. But remember, with undue burden, it's the overall operating costs of the facility. It's not one physician's hourly rate. And so the court found the court argued in favor of the defendant, of the deaf person, and the physician had to pay $400,000 in a jury verdict in addition to $200,000 in punitive damages to the patient. This was the Silva, and then in the Silva versus Baptist Hospital, They did. The 11th Circuit Court did come out with a statement that said deaf patients are not entitled to an on-site interpreter every time they ask for it. If effective communication within the circumstance is achievable with something less than an on-site interpreter, then the hospital is well within its ADA and Rehab Act rights to rely on other alternatives. We stress again that the hospital ultimately gets to decide, after consulting with the patient, what auxiliary aid to provide. But whatever communication aid the hospital chooses to offer, the hospital must ensure effective communication with the patient. So for appointments like blood lab, where you're literally walking in, sitting down, getting your blood drawn, and you leave, or other very simple, very quick appointments may not require an on-site interpreter. You really have to take a look at how much communication is happening, how long is the appointment, how complicated is the information, and if that warrants an accommodation to communication. So things like a lab draw might not warrant any accommodation at all, but if you have a lab draw that's in conjunction with then an appointment, you might want to have the interpreter there, and if they're already there, then sure, they can go into the lab with the patient. It really depends on what kind of communication is happening within the context. Slide 22. Surcharges. As you can see, this is a very simple concept. There's not very much information on this slide because the Rehab Act, ADA, and ACA all prohibit providers from requiring a patient to assume any part of the cost of providing the auxiliary aid and services used as accommodations toward achieving effective communication. So at no time can you ask the patient to assist with the cost of covering the charges of the interpreter of the CART provisions. Also asking the patient to bring their own interpreter. All these kinds of things are illegal under all three laws. They're considered surcharges. Slide 23. So what kind of interpreter do you need? Most situations are going to need your standard sign language interpreter, who is just interpreting between a spoken language and a sign language. In cases where a patient is a deaf immigrant who does not use American Sign Language or may have cognitive disabilities that are going to make it more difficult for them to understand consent to a procedure, for example, you might want to bring in a certified deaf interpreter who is a deaf sign expert or native language model, native language user who works in conjunction with a hearing sign language interpreter. Deaf people are just have a more innate sense of how to get their message across to another deaf person that most hearing sign language interpreters as second language learners just don't have. We, as hearing interpreters, we also don't live as a deaf person day to day and don't have the same experience that might be required in these more complicated situations. Deafblind interpreter. Not all hearing interpreters have experience working with deafblind people or deaf people with low vision. It is a slightly different skill. Not all hearing sign language interpreters want to necessarily do that work because it is a little bit more of a stress on the body. It takes more physical requirements, I guess you'd say. Deafblind interpreter, I'll have some images in a moment. But if you think of Helen Keller, that's the easiest picture I can paint. It's literally interpreting into someone's hand. Sometimes deafblind people may not have their hands on the interpreter's hands, but they'll have them more toward their forearm or elbow just so they can track where the sign language is going. They can track where the limited vision that they have needs to be focused. And there's variations on this. We won't get into it, but Just make sure that you have a sign language interpreter who knows how to provide this service if it is requested. Other services like cued speech, you won't see it as much, and it's harder to find a cued speech interpreter. There's not very many people out there who have that skill. An oral interpreter, we really don't see this very often anymore. We never really did, but it's really becoming a thing of the past. All right, certified deaf interpreters. You might have seen certified deaf interpreters working on the news, especially. They seem to be featured especially in the New York press conferences about the hurricanes. There was one, I think this picture is from the Ebola outbreak a couple years ago. In the bottom right-hand picture, this is slide 24, by the way. Bottom right-hand picture, there is an image of a man speaking at a podium, and to his right, there's another man using sign language, and he is a deaf interpreter who is trying to get this very important information out to a population who might not be able to read the captioning, who might need it in a more accessible way. So the top left image shows how a CDI or a deaf interpreter works. So from the deaf person conveys a message, the CDI takes that message, translates it into ASL or another maybe more English version that the hearing interpreter is able to then receive and speak into English or whatever spoken language is being used. And then it goes back the other way. So it is more of a simultaneous interpreting experience. More of a consecutive interpreting experience instead of simultaneous. It is going to take a little bit longer. But when you have a certified deaf interpreter, sometimes the communication that you've struggled with, perhaps with this one person for so long, is just magical, and everyone is able to understand. And if you haven't had that experience yet, I hope that you will be able to someday. Next slide, slide 25. Here are some images of deafblind interpreting, and you'll see in the top left image, this is more of that, you know, traditional Helen Keller style where deafblind person has their hands on top of the interpreter's hands, and the interpreter is signing continuously with physical contact with that deaf person in that way. The middle image at the bottom, this is more of the tracking style where you don't have the interpreter sitting directly in front of the deafblind person. They're off to the side. The deafblind person has one hand on the interpreter's hand or arm and is able to track sign language in that respect. And then to the right, you have a woman who is using a power chair, and it looks like some kind of breathing device, and the interpreter is has, you know, both hands in the patient's hands. I want to show these images, though, because when we talk about VRI, it's important to keep in mind your patient and what kind of communication is needed, what kind of accommodations are going to be effective. In all three of these situations, I think that having an interpreter on a screen, kind of no matter how big or small that screen is going to be problematic for these people to be able to use that as a communication accommodation. All right, so back to interpreter qualifications. This is slide 26. The three images that I have here are all pictures, unfortunately, from recent situations where fake interpreters have been hired. And you may think, you know, how does this happen? How does this happen so often? Didn't they know that that interpreter was not qualified for the job? But keep in mind that the people who hire sign language interpreters are typically not fluent in sign language. They don't necessarily ask for an interpreter's credentials. They take an interpreter at their word that I'm the sign language interpreter today, and they go with it. So at the top right, you have, this was for the hurricanes in Florida. The guy in the yellow shirt is actually a lifeguard, and he apparently has a cousin who was deaf and So he knows maybe 20 vocabulary signs, but obviously not enough for a press conference about a national disaster. The middle image is a similar situation. I think this was they had caught a criminal. I can't remember what happened here. The woman in black with her hands kind of doing jazz hands out to the side, again, was not credentialed and not qualified. And then the bottom image is Nelson Mandela's funeral. This man with his hands, I guess, up with the blue lanyard around his neck, knew no sign language at all, no South African sign language at all, and was providing basically gibberish the whole time. So this does happen often, and I want to stress that not every interpreter is qualified. Please make sure that when you are hiring interpreter services that you are either asking for their credentials, you're checking your state laws, do they have to be licensed, do they have experience in medical, etc. If you have not checked your state's requirements, there is a website here on this slide that you can access after the webinar to figure out what your state requires and how to access the directories, names and phone numbers, emails, addresses, or email addresses for those interpreters should you need their services. Okay, VRS interpreting. So there's VRI and there's VRS, Video Relay Service. Is the easiest way to think about this one is it's on the telephone. It's phone calls. It's live interpretation on a phone call. So a hearing caller dials a deaf person's phone number. That phone number is registered with the FCC as a video phone. So when a hearing person calls that number, it gets automatically routed through the relay service, through a sign language interpreter. That sign language interpreter connects the call to the video phone and then can hear you in their headset, can hear you and talk to you in their headset, can see the deaf person on the screen and sign with them, and it's live interpretation on a phone call. So I also work as a video relay service interpreter, and I think that it's very savvy for hospitals nowadays to be doing a lot of patient pre-op intake questions, medical history, over video relay service. This is, if you have the time to use this video relay service to do that kind of paperwork with your patients, this is a really savvy resource to utilize. It is free to you. It's free to the deaf person. So video relay service, keep in mind that it's a phone call, though, and two people on both ends must be in separate rooms, separate places, separate facilities. It is illegal to use VRS if both the hearing person and the deaf person are in the same room. So you can't legally be using VRS, the telephone call service, as an accommodation in a medical setting. You know, your patient shows up, can you just call me on your cell phone? That's actually illegal, and you can be fined for this. Next slide is slide 28, VRI, video remote interpreting. So VRI, where VRS, you cannot use it in the same room. VRI is meant to be used where both the hearing person and the deaf person are in the same room. Today, we're using it in this webinar where actually it's not the case. I am in Chicago, the interpreters are in DC, and so that is another use of VRI. But VRI in medical situations are typically where the patient and the provider are sitting in the same room together. The deaf person can see the interpreter on the screen. The interpreter might be sitting in the same state. The interpreter might be sitting in a different state, but the screen is right in there with the deaf patient, and then the provider typically can hear the interpreter as well. So you can have simultaneous interpreting on the screen. And if you look at the images, there are three different setups here. The screen looks like it's on some kind of mobile desk space that can be rolled through different rooms. And the screen is quite large. That, I think, is possibly the ideal VRI setup, but it might not be accessible in every situation. You have in the middle image VRI on a smaller screen. It seems like it's still on that mobile setup. And then on the bottom one, the provider is actually holding, it looks like, an iPad with the interpreter on the screen. That seems problematic to me because somebody's got to be holding the VRI device the whole time. But VRI can be used in the absence of an on-site interpreter. The opportunity to utilize video communication technology to obtain interpretation services is a boon for everyone, especially if you live in a rural space where there are not a lot of sign language interpreters available. There's not a lot of services around in general. So VRI is an answer to that. Slide 29. So why should we use VRI? There are challenges to procuring on-site interpreters. On-site interpreters must be prearranged and take staff time to confirm. They can take 2 to 7 business days in advance to secure an on-site interpreter. In some instances, the agency or the provider has to pay travel time to that interpreter, late notice fees, cancellation fees, evening and weekend differentials, et cetera. There is an interpreter shortage generally ongoing nationwide, especially in rural areas, but I know that in Chicago we really struggle. We don't have enough interpreters to go around, so it's not just rural areas. And then sometimes no interpreter is available immediately, at which further delays occur. Slide 30. Getting set up. This is some of the equipment that you would need to provide those VRI services. I'm just going to skip on to slide 31. The ADA has specific requirements for VRI to be used as an effective accommodation. These are that the real-time full-motion video and audio over a dedicated high-speed, wide-bandwidth video connection or wireless connection that delivers high-quality video images that do not produce lags, choppy, blurry, or grainy images, or irregular pauses in communication. Think back to the last time you used Skype or FaceTime or made a video call with someone of any kind. Was it perfect the entire time? Could you see your person perfectly, or were they choppy, blurry, etc.? Typically, the use of VRI, the quality of VRI or VRS is similar to that. It's not as though VRI and VRS they magically avoid all of the same problems that you might see in FaceTime or Skype. So keep that in mind if you are thinking about using VRI as an accommodation with your patients. The ADA says that also it must be a sharply delineated image that is large enough to display the interpreter's face, arms, hands, and fingers, and the face, the arms, hands, and fingers of the person using sign language regardless of his or her body position. So, obviously, you want to be able to see the interpreter. You don't want their face cut off out of the screen. But then also your patient. Most doctor's appointments, most patients are going to come in being able to move around and reposition to be in the screen. But what if your patient is in a full body cast and they are not able to move to accommodate and reposition themselves to be part of the screen? What if they have CP, and what if they, the list goes on and on. But it's not just that the interpreter needs to be seen, but the deaf person also needs to be able to be seen by the interpreter. And sometimes that makes VRI not an effective accommodation. So obviously the interpreter must be able to have a clear audible transmission of voice. The interpreter needs to be able to hear the provider. That's usually less of a problem, but it still can be. And then adequate staff training to ensure quick setup and proper operation of the VRI machine. That is often a problem. If hospitals have one VRI machine and that VRI machine gets moved from department to department, room to room, suddenly you need the VRI machine and nobody knows where it is. Or maybe it's kept in a closet and only one person in the entire hospital knows which closet it's kept in. It sounds funny, but it happens regularly. So these are all ADA requirements for using effective or using VRI as an accommodation toward effective communication. The other thing, this has nothing to do with the ADA, but just in terms of your practice, think about the cost. A lot of people want to use VRI because they think it's going to save them on cost of interpreting services. But VRI, they charge by the minute. So as an example, if you are being charged $2.50 per minute for 20 minutes of VRI, that will cost you $50, whereas you've got to pay usually a two-hour minimum with an interpreter that you may only use for 20 minutes, and then, you know, you're paying a lot more for underutilized services. However, VRI, in this example, you only have to use it for 45 minutes before you've already started paying more for VRI than you would for 45 minutes with an interpreter with a two-hour minimum. So it's just something to keep in mind. You may or may not actually be skirting the cost of interpreting services by utilizing VRI. Slide 33. So the pros of VRI is a potentially quicker wait in an emergency response situation. If a person runs into the emergency room, needs effective communication, you've got the VRI machine there, you can pull it out. Hopefully you get an interpreter on the screen right away and you're ready to go. That's in an ideal situation. Entities in areas with limited access to qualified on-site interpreters have alternative options. It reduces the propensity for noncompliance with the ADA, ACA, and Rehab Act to achieve effective communication. So this concept of I have something that I can give my patients immediately and not refusing to provide any kind of accommodation. VRI can offer interpreting services during night and weekend hours when on-site interpreters may be harder to secure. Sometimes an increased anonymity for deaf patients. You have access to interpreters outside your local community. The deaf community is very small. The interpreting community is also very small. Everyone tends to know everyone. So maybe you get a deaf patient who doesn't want their local interpreters because they don't want the local interpreters to know all of their personal health information. Understandable. And then VRI is billed per minute, which in some instances can be more economical depending on the need. Slide 34, the cons of VRI. Video picture quality is rarely optimal. This is the number one complaint of use of VRI from deaf people. Staff training on how to use the equipment and service is regularly lacking. Lack of positioning versatility. The screens used are unreasonably small. There was a case a couple years ago where the provider was trying to have the deaf person use VRI on, you know, an iPhone. And so the screen was about 2 inches by 3 inches, and this is supposed to be an effective accommodation. That didn't work so well. Deaf patients want familiar interpreters. So sometimes you do have the opposite. You want a deaf patient who is familiar with that interpreter, who knows their skill, who trusts them, et cetera. With VRI, you do have an inconsistency with interpreters. So when you have an on-site interpreter, you typically have the flexibility of requesting the same interpreter for ongoing visits with a patient that allows for continuity of care. This interpreter already knows what's been going on. They know what kind of communication works best with this patient. Versus VRI, if you use VRI for, let's say it's an emergency room, a patient comes into the emergency room, you pull up the VRI, you're going to get one interpreter for your first 20 minutes, and then you turn the VRI off because the doctor isn't going to come back for a while and the deaf person, there's nothing going on. And then the doctor comes back, you know, an hour and a half later, and you need the VRI again. When you turn it back on, or when you connect to another interpreter, it's not necessarily going to be the same interpreter. So you lose that continuity of care. VRI does not serve deaf, blind, deaf, and low vision patients. There is also sometimes with VRI a potentially long wait for an available interpreter. The interpreters are sitting in either in a call center or sometimes in a remote location but they are still dealing with an incoming queue of calls. Sometimes there are not enough VRI interpreters to go around, so you may be on hold for a long time waiting for a VRI interpreter. You cannot have VRI equipment anywhere near an MRI machine. An interpreter cannot manage the full situation and communication of all people in the room. So sometimes, depending on the situation, as an interpreter in a room, I might become like a traffic conductor, where if I need a few extra moments to expand a concept for this deaf person to make sure that communication has happened, I can easily control the situation and ask the doctor, you know, can you hold on a moment, and vice versa. But if you're on the VRI machine, you have less ability to, as an interpreter, to control that flow of traffic, which can be problematic sometimes. Less optimal than visual conditions for the interpreter to see the patient. Sometimes the lighting in patient rooms, in doctor's offices, is not great, and so you end up with an image on the interpreter's screen of the deaf person. The interpreter cannot see them. If you cannot see your deaf patient, you cannot interpret for them. You have less control of credentialing requirements with VRI, so you don't always have the ability to know, is this interpreter that you're getting on a VRI screen, are they nationally certified, how much experience do they have with this specific medical situation that you're dealing with. It's billed per minute, which can quickly add up, and then sometimes the equipment can break, which is also a common complaint of the deaf community. The equipment is broken. Nobody knows until the patient shows up, and then suddenly you don't have that accommodation available. All right, slide 35. This is more feedback from the deaf community. This is more feedback on VRI from the deaf community directly of why they prefer not to use VRI as opposed to an on-site interpreter. The video quality is regularly pixelated, freezes, jerky, blurring, trailing. The limitations of VRI make it ineffective as an accommodation, so not being able to move it around, the lighting issue. Staff do not know how to use the equipment or do not know where to find the equipment. VRI equipment is broken. Medical providers are not transparent about using it when they say the deaf patient will call the doctor's office beforehand and say, I want to confirm that an interpreter will be there. And the provider says, yes, an interpreter will be provided. And then they get there and the interpreter is actually on the VRI machine and not an on-site interpreter. It feels like a slightly manipulative tactic, and it's a great way to burn a bridge with a patient real quick. And then often there's still a wait involved to get an interpreter on VRI. Slide 36. Again, I'm bringing up these images of deaf-blind interpreting. Now, with information that you have on VRI, it's easy to see that a VRI machine would not be accessible to these patients. Would not be effective. Slide 37. The images on the right are fairly common for any kind of video phone image. So this trailing, blurring, bizarre coloration, this happens often. So this is what happened in this case that was settled, USA versus Doctors Hospital at Renaissance. Deaf parents of a 4-month-old receiving cancer treatment were repeatedly denied effective communication through an on-site interpreter. The hospital tried to use VRI multiple times, but the machine often did not work, and the staff could not find the equipment. The settlement agreement, the link to the settlement agreement, if you're interested in reading it, is provided in this PowerPoint. On to slide 38, Sutherland et al. Versus Bethesda. This is in 2017, and I have an image of Marcel Marceau here because that's basically what ended up happening in this situation. Sandra Sutherland was 70 years old, hospitalized for 2 weeks after a heart attack. The hospital insisted on using VRI during her stay and never provided her with an on-site interpreter. And what's ironic about this case is about 10 years prior, that very same hospital had been disciplined by the Department of Justice for not providing accommodations at all. So now they're providing an accommodation, but they're providing one that is ineffective. The VRI regularly malfunctioned. During her stay, she underwent a procedure before which the doctor, without a live interpreter and the VRI machine that was ineffective, resorted to gesturing his communication, which of course brings all kinds of concerns about consent and any kind of paperwork that would have had to be processed. Obviously, Ms. Sutherland was not pleased, ended up with a complication after the procedure, and she ended up in the ICU where a nurse, when Ms. Sutherland woke up from a short coma, the nurse provided her only written information about the medication that she was being given. So again, obviously ineffective communication and a very stressful experience regarding healthcare for this woman. Her case was seen in addition to others that were brought against Bethesda, but this seemed to be the most egregious out of those cases. If you're interested in that case, I can get you the settlement citation. And then one last one, Silva versus Baptist Hospital of Miami in 2017. Silva, along with others who were brought in this suit, but particularly, these patients visited two hospitals that were under the same parent company on multiple occasions and were repeatedly denied the request for on-site interpreters. The hospital chose to rely on a problematic VRI setup and family or friends when that failed. The 11th Circuit Court said that the hospital tried to say that they were not, or the parent company, excuse me, the parent company tried to say that they should not be sued because they are just the owning company. They were not providing direct service. But the 11th Circuit Court said it doesn't matter if you are not providing direct service, if you are the company responsible for this organization, then you are liable. And also in this case, I think it's on a slide coming up, the hospital also tried to argue that nothing bad happened to these patients on these occasions where effective communication was not garnered, and therefore they should not be held liable. And the 11th Circuit Court said that the outcome of a situation does not negate the responsibility of providing effective communication, of providing accommodations. It's kind of the idea of there's a law that says everyone has to wear seatbelts. It doesn't matter if you get in an accident or not, you still have to wear the seatbelt. Slide 40. So this is a use of VRI. I call it a Cinderella story. This is, I think, the best example of best practices, equitable service, et cetera. This story is from Yomi Rong, who works for Sutter Health Systems in Fremont. Sutter Health Systems in Fremont wanted to start using VRI. There was already, obviously, the deaf community is already not crazy about using VRI. They don't love it usually. Sutter Health Systems in Fremont is set up nearly across the street from the Fremont School for the Deaf, which is obviously a central location for a lot of deaf community activity. A prominent deaf community member got wind of Sutter Health Systems wanting to use VRI and sent a video around social media saying that Sutter was going to force all deaf people to use VRI from now on. There wouldn't be any more options for on-site interpreters. The deaf community responded accordingly with complaints. And so in response, Sutter actually arranged a community forum with their local deaf community and specifically solicited the deaf community for feedback and concerns. Why were they feeling this way? What was going on? What could Sutter do to meet their demands? And the result was that Sutter established a community-based, deaf-led, deaf culture and VRI training program that any department in the hospital, if they want to begin using VRI, the department must complete this training that is led by a local deaf community member that they bring into the hospital. The department has to complete the training, and then only then will they gain access to the use of the machines of VRI. And they also have they maintain a policy that on-site interpreters must remain a respected accommodation option for deaf patients where possible. They also have a policy of maintenance to make sure that there's somebody who is checking the VRI equipment regularly to make sure that it is working. And since then, there has been a great relationship between Sutter Health Systems and the deaf community. Everyone seems very satisfied. VRI is used there for deaf patients who accept it, but it's also not the only option. So that, to me, is above and beyond what a medical facility could do for their deaf community, their deaf population. All right, slide 41. Again, best practices, just be transparent with your patients. If you are trying to use VRI, be upfront with them. Don't leave them assuming that you're getting an on-site interpreter and then have them show up and, oh, big surprise, there's no on-site interpreter. It's actually a machine. You can use VRI as a stopgap for communication needs until an on-site interpreter can arrive. Train your people before they are allowed access to it. That requires semi-frequent refresher trainings. Designate an employee or two or four to test the equipment every so often, maybe once a month, but especially before its services will be needed for an appointment. And then supplement your communication with visual aids, again, going back to that idea of posters or videos that you can pull up in an appointment with your deaf person. Slide 42. So again, with the visual resources, I can't stress it enough. If you can show a deaf person what is going on instead of just tell them, this is very helpful. The idea of a picture is worth 1,000 words. The idea that literacy is not optimal in some cases, and so just like your hearing patients who are not literate in English, how would you approach care in these situations? Etiquette with the interpreter. Avoid saying, tell him, tell her, let them know. Just speak in first person. That is considered most respectful to the deaf person. Do not ever gamble with talking in front of the deaf person and then telling the interpreter, don't interpret that. As interpreters, we are ethically there to interpret all communication that happens. I had a doctor one time talking to other providers in the situation, but right next to the deaf person in vicinity, talking about the fact that this woman was pregnant and she didn't know. And then the woman, of course, reacts, and the doctor is upset with me because I've been interpreting this whole time. You wouldn't speak like that in front of a hearing patient. Why would you assume that you can do it in front of a deaf patient? It's just kind of disrespectful. And then also be careful you don't hand the patient paperwork to the interpreter. This happens more often than you'd think. As an interpreter, I have no business seeing the deaf person's personal paperwork. Again, use your clients as resources, use your patients as resources. They know best how they communicate most effectively. And then also, this is a best practices thing for pediatric inclusion and language modeling. So you might have a 6-year-old patient or a 5-year-old deaf patient with hearing parents. Obviously, the hearing parents are going to be making the medical decisions. But just because the parents are the ones making those decisions, should you not provide an interpreter and completely exclude that young deaf patient? How much would you be interacting with your pediatric patients normally? How much would you be talking to them? Just because they're deaf doesn't mean that should necessarily change, and therefore think about providing that accommodation for effective communication. Slide 43 is just a review on everything that we have discussed. I know we are running over time a little bit in terms of running into our question and answer time. So that finishes up my slides, and I will take questions now.
Great. Thank you very much, Shannon, for that very detailed and informative discussion around these particular issues. At this time, we would welcome you to submit your questions for us, and let us direct our questions to our presenter today. And I'll just this time, Maine, if you would just ascertain whether or not there are any questions for anybody on the telephone before we start.
At this time, I would like to remind everyone, in order to ask a question, press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. Again, that is star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. We will pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster.
And so while we're waiting to see if there's anybody who is going to ask any questions, we do have some that have been submitted through the webinar platform, so I'll go ahead and start with those, Shannon, while we're waiting. What if the patient shows up with his or her own interpreter for the lab draw? Is the hospital responsible to pay for the interpreter when the interpreter was not requested by the patient prior to their lab appointment?
No. If a deaf person shows up with their own interpreter that has not been prearranged or no contract has been signed by the hospital or practice, no, you're not responsible to retroactively pay that interpreter.
So what will be best practice to reschedule and address the communication needs at that time?
It depends on the nature of the visit. So if it's just a lab draw, I don't personally necessarily see the need for rescheduling a lab draw. If it is a more in-depth appointment involving a more complicated interaction, diagnosis, discussion of treatment plan, then I would say rescheduling sounds reasonable. If they prefer to use their own interpreter, they can, even if that interpreter is a family member. In some circumstances, they can. Sometimes it gets a little tricky with state laws regarding who can legally function as an interpreter. So long as that interpreter that they've brought personally is an adult, they can use them. It is, in most cases, illegal or strongly discouraged from using children as interpreters. There are a couple case laws that I can get to you later if you email me regarding instances where children were used as interpreters and it resulted in some negative results, and the hospitals were later sued for using children as interpreters. So as long as that person is an adult, then it's possible, yes, they could be used as an interpreter, depending on the nature of the visit.
Great, thank you. Here's another question we have. Let me go back to the phone. Were there any questions on the phone, Maine?
Your first question comes from the line of Erin.
Go ahead.
Ask your question.
Why don't you check to make sure your mute is not on? Your line is active. Go ahead.
Is this my line? I'm not sure.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Go ahead.
My question is, I know of people who, for example, in an OBGYN setting or having a vaginal exam, have been told they had to use VRI and they did not feel comfortable because of being on the screen undressed, and they were still told that they had to use VRI. Can you address that?
Thank you.
Sure. Thank you for the question. I would be curious as to, number one, the reasons why they're being told they have to use VRI. Language like that, I would hesitate to take it at its word. But in terms of not wanting to possibly be on screen, unclothed, et cetera, in those kinds of situations is absolutely reasonable. There is an option if the patient desires to turn the VRI off in certain situations. Same as you might ask a live interpreter for any kind of invasive exam to just step out of the room for a moment, and then they can be right back. It depends on the preference of the deaf person, what they choose, but I would start at the beginning of why are they being told that they must use VRI and that no other accommodation is considered.
What they were told was that the hospital has a contract, and that's the equal access that they are providing.
So they're basically saying that was their only option.
Right.
Just because the hospital has a contract with a VRI service doesn't mean that that then becomes the only option. They obviously are still very capable of hiring an on-site interpreter. But again, if that is the situation, obviously it's hard to stop in the middle of everything and fight about interpreter stuff. But there is always an option to turn the VRI machine off for that part of the exam that is going where a patient might be exposed. There's also hopefully the ability to move the VRI machine so that if in using your example, the machine would be closer to the patient's face. The camera would only be facing the patient's face and not getting a full image of the full room in questionable angles, et cetera.
Yeah, they were really concerned about being filmed and somebody having that document, basically.
VRI calls are not recorded. You know, there wouldn't be a document after the fact, but again, I would want to revisit that idea of we have a contract, therefore it's the only option. What are they going to do if a deafblind person shows up and they say this is the only accommodation we have because we have a contract? Well, it's not effective. So they're going to have to figure out something else, and if they can figure out something else for that deafblind person, then why can't they figure out something else for a deaf patient in this kind of a situation?
Absolutely. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Mm-hmm. Someone's asking, Shannon, about HIPAA and what interpreters can and cannot know.
So interpreters adhere to a strict code of ethics that has basically the exact same confidentiality, if not more confidentiality, regarding patient information. In fact, sometimes I know that providers can be so concerned about confidentiality and HIPAA that they don't want to disclose information to an interpreter in the context of an appointment or something like that. And it actually hinders an interpreter's ability to do the job. We're there to facilitate communication, and that's all. We're not collecting any kind of documentation about it. We're held to very strict ethical confidentiality restrictions, and our license can be in jeopardy if we violate those. So, regards to HIPAA, there should be no problem with an interpreter, you know, being there for all the nitty gritty details.
If they choose to use a family member to interpret, what risks regarding confidentiality are on the hospital staff by providing information to a family member?
So I would start with the patient. Are they comfortable using that family member? Is that family member an adult? If the family member is a child, I would say confidentiality doesn't even come into play. That's a big no-no. If the family member is an adult and the patient agrees to use the family member, then I would say treat it as any other patient who walks in with a family member. Do you censor any information for that hearing patient, or do you allow the family member in into that intimate setting? If the patient has any qualms with using the family member as an interpreter, then I obviously would respect that, and then also keep in mind that family members, because they're not trained interpreters a lot of the time, because they also sometimes struggle with fluency, are not going to be your best bet for proving that you are complying with these federal requirements of providing effective, of achieving effective communication. And, you know, you can use that family member, but then if you are taken to court or sat in front of a panel of judges saying, you know, did you do your best to find a qualified interpreter as stated in the ADA, you're going to want to be able to back that up.
So we have a couple of people asking about cost issues. So one was, what is the particular standard rate that you're aware of for video remote interpreting? And the other is, do you have an idea what it costs for basic setup for VRI?
I do not know the average cost. Again, mine was, my example that I did was just an example, and it was actually from a colleague of mine who had done a presentation a few years ago, so the cost may have changed in that time. I would suggest just calling a company that provides VRI and ask for a consultation, ask for their rates. You know, they would best be able to advise you on what getting set up would look like financially and logistically.
What about, do you know anything about the cost of a setup at all? Have you had experience with that?
I have not. I don't know if, I mean, regarding the equipment for needed, you're going to need a camera and speakers, and I don't know if your hospital might have some of that already, or if it has to be special VRI equipment provided to you by the company. Again, I would call the VRI company and get that squared away with them.
Great, thanks. Question here, that they've heard of situations where hospitals who used VRI also had a non-certified assigner in the room to fill in temporarily when VRI freezes or until they could get it working again. Do you feel that is a legal alternative?
It depends what state you're in. So in the state of Illinois, that would not be legal because of our state laws regarding who can function as an interpreter in medical settings. In New York, that might be an option because they don't have any state laws. I know that in Washington, D.C., while they may not have any state laws regarding that kind of thing, they have such a high standard and small community of users that might not be acceptable, and you might get into some hot water very quickly. So it just depends on your state law in terms of what is legal. Now, again, I would caution, is this person who is uncertified, are they qualified? Just because you're not certified doesn't necessarily mean you're not qualified, but, you know, what makes them credentialed or what makes them fitting for this situation? And if they're not able to provide that communication effectively, then yeah, I would say just hold on until you can get the VRI working again, or until you can get a qualified certified interpreter.
And the other question you have here is, do you have any suggestions of what or who a patient should ask for when they're trying to get effective communication access in a hospital? This person says in the past there used to be patient reps or advocates, but that person's position doesn't seem to be around anymore in the current healthcare system. Do you have any suggestions?
That is a great question, and unfortunately there's no good answer because every hospital has it set up differently. So sometimes you'll see hospitals in metropolitan areas actually have an entire office dedicated to interpreter services. Sometimes it's patient advocacy, the patient advocate office, sometimes it's patient relations, but then sometimes depending on how the hospital has billing set up, each department is responsible for procuring their own services, so it gets really complicated. If you have access to a social worker, sometimes they know who to get in touch with within the hospital, and then some hospitals will have an ADA coordinator, so you might want to check if the hospital has that, but really it does take a little bit of legwork on the part of the patient sometimes to just figure out who to talk to and how to get to that correct person.
Great. And someone here said that just did make a note that they're a male interpreter, and that they have interpreted OB and childbirth for individuals who were deaf, and that they said that the doctor was always good about something if it was private to ask them to leave the room, and that seemed to be okay and worked well with the clients if it was discussed in advance. So they were just providing that little insight there from their own personal experiences, really, that previous question. We're at the bottom of the hour, but I want to check because I don't want to leave them off. Is there anybody else on the telephone, Maine, that had any questions or anybody else in the queue?
Your next question comes from the line of Fabiola. You may ask your question.
Hello.
Go ahead.
I have a question. We had a situation in our hospital where a patient who was not deaf had a family member who was deaf, and the family member was asking for an interpreter for himself, but he was not the patient. I thought the appropriate thing was to get an interpreter as soon as possible, because I figure this was an emergency department situation. I figure if the patient herself collapsed or faints or anything, the decision maker becomes that family member that was with the patient. So, but they were telling the patient, no, you know, you're not the patient. We'll get you the video machine. The patient's family member had visual issues and couldn't use the video machine. But I just wonder, you know, for other situations where patients come to clinics, for example, that are not deaf and they bring their family members, what will be the appropriate thing? Should we get interpreters? Because in our organization, we only provide video interpreters when there's last-minute situations while an interpreter gets here, or when, you know, there's short situations, like a lab situation, but we know already the patient is okay with using the video machine. If they're not, we will get them an interpreter regardless of if it's just 15 minutes and we have to leave for 2 hours. But I wanted to know, in situations where the patient is not deaf, and then the family member, and they're asking for an interpreter for a family member, what's the appropriate thing? If it's okay to use video interpreter, because sometimes we don't even know this family member's, you know, preferences.
Sure.
We try to learn, you know, the preferences of our patients ahead of time.
Right. So this is a very common question. Does the right to accommodation and effective communication extend to companions, to family and friends who show up with patients? And the answer is yes in most situations. And again, like you said, if something happens with the patient, then that family member, the next of kin, whoever's there, is going to become a resource for you as to how to proceed. Also, in cases where, you know, maybe a mother is hearing but the father is deaf and they are scheduled for a Lamaze class, you know, technically the mother is the patient, but the father is going to be part of that care as well, and also has that right to effective communication. In a lot of cases, a hearing patient, their care team or the family members, the deaf family members, might be the ones responsible for caring for them after, you know, post-op or whatever it might be, in cases where maybe a parent is aging and a deaf child is becoming their caregiver. Those rights extend to the family members. So even though the patient is hearing, family members do, they are protected in terms of of having the right to an accommodation, and your instinct in that case was exactly right, that they do have a right to an interpreter. And then once you get to, you know, they have a right to an accommodation, then you need to find out what accommodation is effective. Just because they're not the patient doesn't mean that suddenly they get stuck with, you know, whatever accommodation is most convenient or is left over. They are a companion that has a right to an effective communication. They have a right to an accommodation, and that accommodation needs to be accessible to them.
Thank you.
The rule of thumb is that whoever you would be communicating with who did not have a disability, if you would be communicating with them, and the same would hold true for the person who, had a disability. So if you would be communicating with their family members or their friends or whatever, even if they aren't the person with the disability, but the family members, again, think about it, take the disability out of it. Would we normally communicate with this person? If so, then we would need to make sure that it's effective. Okay, sounds great. We're at the bottom of the hour. And again, I want to thank you, everyone who participated in today's session. And I hope that you found the content valuable and useful to you. We will be sending out an email at the conclusion of the session, which will alert you to the availability of the recording, the evaluation. For today's session, we do value your feedback, so please fill that out, as well as information on how you can go about obtaining the recording of the session once it is available and ready to be posted. So again, thank you very much for your participation. Your contact information for Shannon is on the screen, as well as in your handout materials. So if you would like to follow up, please feel free to do so. Otherwise, thank you very much on behalf of the ADA National Network and the ADA Great Lakes ADA Center. Should you have questions related to the Americans with Disabilities Act or follow up to today's session, please make sure you have contact with your regional ADA center by calling 800-949-4232, or to find the center that serves your area, go to www.adata.org. Again, thank you very much. To close out today's session, if you're on the telephone, you can just hang up the telephone. If you're in the webinar platform, you can just close out your browser and or use the file exit option in the upper left-hand corner of your screen. So thank you very much, and have a great day.
This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.